Thanks very much, Chris. Before I start, can I just please thank Chris and Matthew, who isn't here, and Suzanne for organizing this wonderful event. It's a real privilege to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'll read the paper. I started with an epigraph from Paul Ricoeur. Hauntedness is to collective memory what hallucination is to private memory, a pathological modality of the incrustation of the past at the heart of the present. The project of transitional justice unfolds at the interstices of human rights, international law, and comparative political science. Arguably, it has become, a quote from Turner, the dominant language in which the move from war to peace is being discussed in early 21st century. Specifically focused on emerging democracies in post-authoritarian and post-communist settings, its foundational rationale was to develop appropriate juridical and quasi-juridical mechanisms for addressing past violence and injustice. This paper proposes that transitional justice project stands in a difficult, perhaps paradoxical relation to the task of memory and memorialization, and that literature is in a unique position to disclose and illuminate that difficulty. On the one hand, of course, it's been argued that redressive goals require uncovering, preserving, and honoring memories of past victims. Farida Shahid, the United Nations Special Rapporteur in the field of cultural rights, has argued in her recent report that memorialization, I quote, provides means of ensuring recognition for the victims of past violence, reparation for mass and grave violations of human rights, and a guarantee of non-recurrence. On the other hand, however, memory of violence addresses its psychic, political, and cultural continuities, as violence leaves an erasable trace onto the present. From this perspective, memorialization becomes a kind of recognition of the diverse ways in which past violence continues to occupy, or as some have put it, to haunt, the present. In contrast, the politics of redress and reconciliation, at least in this sort of institutional legalistic framing at its origins, was underpinned by a rather different temporal assumption, which are ideologically structured by the teleological grammar of the project, and which crystallize within the rubric of transitional time, as that which radically separates the authoritarianism and repression of the past from the peaceful future. As Max Pensky has shown, the liberal theory of justice, upon which the Transitional Justice Project was founded at its origins, operates upon an impoverished notion of historical time, in that it offers no tools to grapple with the task of doing justice to the dead, be it as atonement or as an amnestic solidarity. This, in turn, problematizes transitional justice and its language of rights insofar as it relies on the liberal paradigm of linear and predictive time. What is the role of literature in transitional justice? This workshop asks. Literature, Richard Eldridge says, focuses on the particular in the universal, undertaking to track what is most likely to come, tragically or comically, of the bearing of particular passions and circumstances that remain always in part intractable. In the context of transitional justice, I argue, literature can not only illuminate the complex ways in which violent past is negotiated, remembered, and disavowed, thus disrupting the neat transitional periodicity of past and present, but it can also frame memory and forgetting as ethical tasks. What I would like to propose then is that in the question, what is the role of literature in or within transitional justice, it is that in or within that troubles me. This is insofar as it draws up an imaginary of containment or withinness. I want to suggest an idea or a figure of the literary as an optic onto transitional justice, one that is uniquely equipped precisely in its non-containment, non-correspondence, non-identity to redressive and reconciliatory preoccupations to disclose the internally fractured and troubled character of that project. So what I mean here is not the sort of different cultural political enactments of transitional justice that can have flaws and problems, of course they do and they need to be discussed, but rather that we think of some of these tensions as something that is internal to it. One would always want to say constitutive tensions in transitional justice. In the paper, I'll gesture at three such tensions without exhausting the list. First, the question of historical time and how it's being subsumed under the rubric of transitionality. Second, figuring memory and forgetting in antagonistic oppositional terms. I think that literature can help to refigure that interplay non-oppositionally, insofar as memory, recollection, in order to declare its presence and self-presence, has always already been penetrated by forgetting, that is, by the effacing of memory traces. And third, the anthropocentric bias, in that what is lingering at its peripheries, unaddressed or insufficiently addressed, I think, is the question of things. I'll call them memory object. The paper has three parts. First, I'll look closer at the question of historical time in transitional justice, in particular as regards the discursive investment in a strong separation of the repressive past, the violent past, and the redressive present. Second, I turn to novel by Jean Cabret, Confessions, and trace how the novel organizes its narrative of violent history around the question of materiality of memory objects. In particular, there's a number of objects in that novel, but I'll look in particular at one, an 18th century Storioni violin, which both fragile and durable contrasts with, but also helps to amplify the vulnerability of human lives that it connects over centuries. I'll show how through the complex interconnections and negotiations of meanings that these objects acquire, but also disavow, somehow outside of that meaning-making, Europe violence history contours contemporary life of the novel's key protagonists. And finally, I consider the idea of memory object as an opening into a non-human-centric thinking about memory and justice. So the first section, temporality of transitional justice. Paige Arthur says that transitional justice emerges within an intellectual framework of a series of international conferences in the early 1990s, which organized the nascent field around the concept of transition. Transition was defined specifically in terms of reforms establishing liberal democracy and the rule of law. The result is a certain homogenizing effect, that's Paige's term, on its discursive field, a non-admission of alternative conceptual possibilities. As Turner argues, with the emergence of the model of transitional justice came an exclusionary force whereby those seeking redress must do so in the language of liberal democracy and human rights, thus inherently delimiting the narration of violence. And I'll argue that it's precisely the emergence of memory in that field that happens somewhat later that subverts this sort of conceptual apparatus, this liberal apparatus. This initial formulation of transitional justice coincides with the conspicuous absence at its genesis, one that has been to an extent rectified, which is the non-inclusion of concerns around historical memory and memorialization. Both are related, so this sort of non-inclusion is related to sociological undercurrent upon which transitional justice project relied in its initial articulation, namely transitology, the transitological theory of regime change. Related to critiques of modernization theory as the explanatory paradigm of change, transitology purported the view that the development and consolidation of democratic governance was an uncertain, precarious, highly elite-dependent process. The transitological legacy structures the temporal imaginary of transitional justice project, or more specifically organizes its notion of historical time in relation to justice. Transitology has critiqued modernization theory for its reliance on the historiography of progress. And it, some would say, or some have argued, it actually has bought up to another version of historiography of progress, and hence of historical continuity, and has asserted instead a far more discontinuous, interrupted, stochastic notion of political time, recognizing the multilinear and open-ended character of political change. Accordingly, the transitional period has been conceptualized as a relatively brief, fixed interregnum with a distinct end, where the ideas of breaking with the past and never again mold a definite sense of now and then. That transitional justice figured the promise of new beginning meant that it has become tied closely with the narration of the end of history, mapping the transitological binary of past as violence and presence as after violence. Now, to imagine political past, present, and future as sequential and discontinuous with one another potentially obscures the ways in which historical violence and repression remain in existence
either as tangible sociocultural, sociopolitical continuities, institutional continuity often, but also as a psychic reality of the victim, or as resonances, reverberations of historical trauma in post-conflict communities. Interested in the way that history of suffering and justice can constrain, produce, or occupy the present, Wendy Brown draws attention to the teleological imaginary of time involved in redressive politics. She asks, once guilt is established and a measure of victimization secured by an apology or material compensation, is the historical event presumed to be concluded, sealed as past, healed, brought to a closure? The transitological temporality that overdetermines the past in relation to redressive goals has been complicated with an increasing focus on memory and memorialization within the project. Memorialization is an organizing concept for a variety of anamnestic and commemorative practices, which have the potential, I think, to disrupt the transitological or transitional, sorry, temporality by gesturing as past violence as that which continues to reside in the present and which makes ethical demands. In the space of collective pursuits of redress and reconciliation, memory can mark a space of the singular which exceeds and remains undisciplined by this political juridical register of transitional justice, and that which codes in transitional justice the stubborn presence or stubborn residue of what is unaddressed or unredressive, unreconciliatory, a loss, as Perrin says, that is irrecoverable, incalculable, immemorial. Let me now show how this plays out and operates in Jaume Cabret's novel. So just a few words about Jaume Cabret. He's a Catalan philologist, novelist, a short story writer, and a screenwriter as well, born in 1957. His first work appeared in the 1970s, but it isn't until four of his novels, The Cobweb in 1984, Lordship 1991, The Shadow of the Eunuch 1996, and The Voices of Panama, that themes of historical violence, historical memory, questions of forgiveness, forgetting, but also preoccupation with local Catalan history and attention to the aesthetic field, particularly music, crystallize as sort of dominant themes or dominant threads in his writing. The novel I will talk about, Confessions, it's actually, I do need to confess, I don't read Spanish, so I read it in Polish translation. The English translation is not coming until next year, so it's one of those sort of European situations in which it's being translated far sooner into French, German, and some of the minor languages like Polish before it's published into English. There we go. Confessions centers around the life narrative of Adria Ardevol, a son of antique collector Felix Ardevol in Barcelona. Adria grows up in a rather unloving but scholarly demanding household, surrounded by antique objects, old manuscripts, and musical instruments. His linguistic, academic, and musical skills lead him to undertake an ambitious scholarship in the history of European ideas and philosophy. Adria devotes his whole life to knowledge. He is a violinist, a humanist, a collector of manuscripts, a doctoral student in Tübingen, and then a professor of aesthetics at the University of Barcelona. Now, Adria's most ambitious work is a treatise on the philosophical nature of evil, which he never finishes. The work disavows the metaphysical discourse on evil and posits that the inquiry into the nature of evil carries ethical weight only in as much as it focalizes untold sufferings. The manifestation of evil resides for him not in the European meta-historical narratives, but in the singular story of suffering of Europe's others. It is as such that memory failure being in the sort of thematized as the untellability of the story of the other's suffering, renders the philosophical reflection on evil void, and lends itself to literature. This is telling in as much as in Confessions, philosophy or Western philosophy itself is implicated in the history of violence. The history of modern European thought, as Adria suggests, makes grandiose gestures to attend to the problem of evil, but is unable to remember suffering. Perhaps more importantly, it is also unable to forget suffering in an ethical sense of forgetting, inasmuch as both remembrance and forgetting for in confessions, the way that Cabrera articulates them, are ethical tasks. Both forgetting and remembrance are forms of attention to suffering in its singularity, and as such are constitutive of a mourning subject, of the grieving subject. Adria's life narrative is interwoven with a myriad of other stories of suffering and confessions placed in European medieval, colonial, and modern contexts, including the Jewish persecution during the Spanish Inquisition and the experiments conducted by Nazi doctors in extermination camps. The complex connections and overlappings of Europe's violent history and Adria's confessions are thematized in the novel through a world of antiquarian objects, including a violin by Lorenzo Storioni, a medieval medallion representing Santa Maria de Perdac, a painting by Urgell, I have actually a copy of that painting here, of monastery Santa Maria de Gerri, which is one of the crucial sites in the novel, and a table serviette taken absent-mindedly by a Belgian Jew, Matthias Alperts, when his family is arrested and transported to Auschwitz. These objects focalize actions of the many protagonists in the novel and become an optic onto violence that they perpetuate and suffer. The effects of these actions are felt later, elsewhere, by others. Small changes, decisions but also indecisions, hesitations, even minute gestures can have significant outcomes for the lives of distant others. The material objects in the novel translate the grand historical perspective of European conflict and minority persecution into individual and often intimate micro-histories of violence. A longer quote from Guillamon, who writes about the book. Every time Adria or his father read a manuscript or touch one of the precious objects related with a violin, a leap in time takes the reader back to the 14th century, for example, after the death of Joseph de Saint-Barthélemy, prior to the Saint-Père de Brugal Monastery, when the last remaining monk, Julia de Sau, leaves its grounds with the founding documents and the box of relics, or to the Birkenau concentration camp, where Dr. Albert Voigt and Konrad Baden carry out their experiments on young children, cutting the patellar tendon and applying bound ointment to see if any regenerative process takes place without the aid of sutures. These frameless flashes interrupting the novel make it possible to reconstruct the history of horror underlying the urge to possess beauty. There's so many plots in the novel, so what I've decided to do more specifically is to focus on the story of the violin and show how this operates. That construction, constitution of the mourning, grieving subject, the ethical tasks of memory, but also ethical tasks of forgetting, and the memory objects. To make it a bit easier for you, I spent last night sort of mapping genealogy of the violin, and I'll talk about it. It looks like a really complex. So if you find this difficult, see if you can follow the narrative. So just follow the arrows. Well, that's a story perhaps of any violin, isn't it? The origin of the violin is to be found in a few maple and spruce seeds. Guerra de Sault offers the seeds to the priest, Miquel de Sascueda, as a payment for a confession she requests. She seeks absolution for a suicide she has not yet committed, but she's about to, being disgraced by a violent rape by Miquel's superior, the Inquisitor General, Nicol Aymeric. Miquel denies the requests, but he takes and hides the seeds in the pockets of his cassock, as he subsequently escapes Emmerich's vengeance for his refusal to comply with the Inquisitor's order to tear out the tongue of a tortured Jewish doctor. Changing his name to Julia de Sau, he joins the remote Benedictine order of Saint-Père de Brugal in northern Catalonia. After 20 years of penitent monastic life, and on the day of the monastery's closure, Miquel is actually killed at Emmerich's order and buried in unconsecrated land. The dormant seed, still in the pockets of his cassocks, kept as a private relic and as a reminder of his own complicity with the fanaticism and violence of the Inquisition, but also to his indifference to Guerra's suffering, now begin to sprout in the coolness and moisture of Miquel's burial soil. Feeding on the decomposing tissue of his corpse, the seeds germinate and grow into maple and spruce trees. 3 centuries later, Jacquia Mureda, a fugitive from the North Italian region of Pardak. With a tragic story himself, visits the ruins of Saint Pierre de Bougal in a search for wood to be used in violin making. Mureda finds the maple tree rooted in a human skeleton. The superb quality of the wood earns him a fortune after he sells it to the workshop of Antonio Stradivari, perhaps the most famous of Cremonese luthiers of the classical period. A few decades later, only one remaining piece of maple wood is acquired by Zosimo Bergonzi, who then presents it to his student Lorenzo Storioni, then unknown Lorenzo Storioni. Storioni is known to be the last of the classic luthiers in Cremona, and known for having introduced some bold modifications at the time into the craft of violin making, including precisely the use of materials such as white maple wood. The connection between the house of Bergonzi and Storioni's emergence as the last Cremonese luthier has been historically documented, but what Cabret does in the novel is he fictionalizes this relationship through a secret love story. Lorenzo and Bergonzi's daughter, Maria, are in love, but her father is determined to prevent their secret engagement. He has other plans for Maria, and he offers his student Lorenzo the valuable piece of maple wood for free, but as a remuneration for his rejection of Maria's love. Lorenzo complies. He breaks Maria's heart and gives the material for his first violin. The infidelity to love and the evanescence of happiness in the face of human desire to possess and accumulate are transcribed into the story of the violin at its inception. Lorenzo's betrayal of Maria mirrors Argia's own disloyalty and infidelity to Sarah three centuries later, Sarah, his Jewish fiancée, who demands that he returns to the violin to its rightful owners. The violin's first owner, a Parisian aristocrat, Jean-Marie Leclerc, is a victim of his nephew, François Vial, whose hatred for his uncle and the desire for the violin fuse into a gory passion and accumulate in Leclerc's murder. The scratch on the inside of the violin that Adria finds and the spatter of blood are traces that still remains three centuries later, are traces of the violent appropriation of the instrument. Sorry, no playing with the microphone. The violin is then bought by Nicolas Arcan from Antwerp, and it remains with the Arcan family until the 20th century, when under certain sudden impoverishment, the Arcans sell Viol, so the name of the violin, to Belgian Jewess Netje de Beck, who has purchased it for her daughter, Bertha Alperts, the violinist with the Philharmonic Orchestra of Antwerp. When Netje and the whole family of Alperts, including Bertha, her husband Matthias, and three daughters, Amelia, Trudy, and Julia, are arrested at their dinner table and transported to Auschwitz, they take with them Viol, their dearest possession. During the selection process, the old violin case attracts attention of Sturmbannführer Arbeit Vogt, a fictional character of an Auschwitz doctor modeled on Dr. Mendele, involved in the medical experimentations on camp prisoners. Vogt shoots Netje at close range at the selection site, and he steals the violin. The unremoved blood traces, now also of Netje, in the creases of the violin testify to the robbery. He then blackmails the camp commandant, Rudolf Höss, and shortly before the arrival of Soviet troops to the camp, manages to destroy the documents connecting him to the human experimentation program. That's why we have never heard of Vogt, but we have heard of Mendele. After the war, Vogt hides under the name of Felgnami, under the protection of Father Felix Morlin, in the Vatican City, enlisted with the task of a porter, ironically, at the Pontifisco Consigliere della Giustizia del Passe, a reference perhaps to Max Alderfer in Liliana Scavani, The Night Porter. It is here that he and Adria's father, Felix Ardevol, cross pathways. Felix Ardevol is an owner of an extensive collection of antique objects with a shop in Barcelona, who built the collection before and during the war by fraudulently acquiring valuable objects from their Jewish owners, and who continues his practice after the war with what we might call a slight change of direction. His interest is still in Jewish objects, but his clients, quote-unquote, are their new owners, the Nazi fugitives on their way to South America, who in the 1940s and 50s were circulating in Barcelona under the protection of the Franco regime. Felix blackmails Albright Voigt into relinquishing the rights to the violin, which becomes his most valued possession. However, a decade later, Voigt takes his revenge. He lures Felix into a remote location and then murders and decapitates him. Adria is then 10 years old, and he becomes implicated in the destruction and deceit that formed the story of the violin by accidentally contributing to his father's death. That is, he, just before his father leaves home, he replaced viol with his own school violin in the case just because he wanted secretly practice on viol. Thus, struggling with guilt of real but also imaginary patricide, Adria says, just as Brynhild inadvertently sends Siegfried to his death by revealing his weakness to his enemies, so did I, by exchanging the violins, decide about the fate of the father who did not love me. Adria inherits the father's antique collection, and with the violin, and with it the violin, and also, it seems, Felix's all-consuming and all-destructive desire to possess beautiful objects. His unnegotiable attachment to the violin ruptures the relationship with Sarah, who demands that the violin be returned to the descendants of the Jewish owners, and who also objects in and who also sees objects in Ardeval's possessions as markers of violent expropriation and untold suffering. I'm moving now to the final part of the paper, memory objects. Cabret's decision to locate a Storioni violin at the center of his multiplot story as a connective of its various instantiations of violence and suffering gestures at the co-implicatedness of things in the formation of the psychic and cultural responses to historical trauma. Instead of the periodicity of radically opposed past as the locus of violence and the presence as that which is devoid of violence, that is, which is after violence, memory objects disclose an intricate mosaic of continuities and discontinuities of violence. Memory objects are accidental to violence. They are inscribed in it as instruments of atrocity, or they can be inscribed in it as instruments of atrocity, as witnesses of justice, but also as targets of violence. Memory things are also irreducible to the gestures of political intentionality to commemorate, and exceed the anamnestic semantics assigned to them with redressive discourses. They are more like ruins than they are like commemorative artifacts. Peter Stalibrach writes that, I quote, wrinkles and tears in clothes of 19th century English tailors were commonly called memories, and that as such they memorized the interaction, the mutual constitution of people and things. Similarly, the violin bears marks, scratches, scars, indentations, blood spatter in its creases, of the suffering it witnessed over centuries, standing both for the embeddedness of its memory in the violin's materiality, but also for the forgetting as well, insofar as it signifies the untold, but perhaps also untellable story of the other's suffering. Europe's history of violence, focalized through the personal stories of suffering and of wrongdoing of Guerra, Michel, Jacquiam, and others, does not simply inscribe its traces onto the violent surface as if it was external to its existence, but violence becomes integral to the process of its formation, both to the desires in its sights and the pleasures it gives. The violence both symbolizes and materializes the continuity of the violent past. In political terms, the fraudulent acquisition is possible because the denazification process has been a highly restricted and self-serving exercise. As a psychic reality of the surviving victims, in particular Sarah's uncle, Epstein, who is a survivor from Auschwitz but who takes his own life in 1950s, and as a generationally transmitted trauma of violence and repression, which is channeled for Sarah, it's sort of personified in Sarah's character, as the unceasing and unremitting grief and mourning. Sarah says, I cannot live without grief. This is her confession to Adria. I have a feeling that when the grief passes, I will sin against the memory of my kin, the memory of my uncle. I have many deceased. Taking inspiration, though not necessarily committed to the speculative realist perspective on shared inorganicism of human and non-human bodies, I want to suggest that memory objects require a non-mechanistic understanding of memory's thingness, this inscription of memory into things. Excuse me. Rather than being inert and determined, the violin is a composite of many different bodies, right? Gwerg has seeds, the tissue of Mikkel's corpse, Moreda's olfactory skills at wood recognition, Storjoni's artisanship, Nedje's blood, Bernard's violinist mastery. And in a wider sense, it also congeals onto itself acts of violence, participates in them, witnesses them, and performs actions. Of course, actions not in a strong causal and intentional sense, but in a sense given to it by Bruno Latour, among others, in which anything that modifies a state of affairs by making a difference is an actor. The mnemonic powers of the violin draw from its capacity for making a difference to the world and to other beings. It provides a sublime experience, a sublime aesthetic experience to those who play and who listen to it throughout centuries, but it also engenders passionate and predatory desire that lead to more violence and destruction, thus illuminating the desire to possess, to contain beauty, by which the protagonists become locked into a compulsive repetition of the past. Imagine, says Felix, our devil, to Adria, that this violin had adventures we will never know about. It played in concert halls and homes that we will never visit. It shared joy and sadness of musician which used it. How many conversations did it listen to? How much music it experienced? The violin does not belong to me. It is me who belongs to it. And Adria says to Bernard, his friend, it is the violin that decides because it is alive. The mutual constitution of memorable objects, the untold, untellable story of suffering as the other of violence, and that of the grieving, mourning subject in confessions, poses an important question to those who feel addressed to attend to past injustice. In the face of the recognition that the call to transitional justice is to settle the past, that is fundamentally, perhaps constitutively, an impossible pursuit, how does one articulate that unsettled past as certain ethics of incompletion? How does one reflect back onto the redressive imperative from the side of the unredressed and unredressive that both literature and memory speak of? Thank you.